Hey everybody, what's up? I'm Chase Jarvis, a photographer and an entrepreneur. I'm really excited to be here with Brian Elliott. And what's the name of the show?
You're watching Behind the Brand.
Behind the Brand.
This is off to a really good start. Chase, what's up? Welcome to the show and thanks for taking a minute. I know you're on vacation, at least I assume you are. And I want to hear all about your story, but I usually ask my guests, how'd you get this job?
How'd you get this job? And I don't know if I can call this a job, right? I think we're all hyphens. We all do so many things. And if I was to try and write down the job description, even the way I think of it in my mind, that would be a long ass job description. But I'll do my best. So I feel like there were 20 years of my life, maybe more, where I really pursued and acted and did all of the things that the rest of the world wanted me to do. And just through a handful of incidents in my, I would say young adult, early adulthood, where I really recognized that I couldn't be the best version of myself if I did the things that everybody else wanted. So I began an imperfect, awkward journey towards pursuing the things that I wanted to be and do and become in this world. And it was through that awkward, stumbling, imperfect journey that I ended up with this job, where today I consider myself a multi-hyphenate, a photographer, a creator, and an entrepreneur.
So let's go back in the chronology a little bit.
Sure.
You sort of alluded, I'm reading through the lines a little bit, that people had expectations that you're going to become whatever. What was that expectation and what was the path that you were on early on? What did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I think what I wanted to be was potentially unfairly shaped by all of the inputs that we have as young people, right? Not only do we have culture telling us what we have to look like and be like, but we also have our parents and our career counselors and our grandparents and friends and spouses and peers. And here's the kickers. All those people mean so well. They love us and care for us. But the reality is that advice is terrible advice because that what they're encouraging us or coaching us is around their ideals, their aspirations, what would make them look good or feel good to know that we had X, Y, or Z job. And in reality, you know, all of those inputs wanted me to be a pro athlete or a doctor or someone that was well respected in the community in the most typical and traditional sense. And
were you a soccer player?
Yeah. I went to, grew up, you know, played soccer and football, lots of sports, but on the team side, soccer and football, I could have gone to college on scholarship for either. I chose soccer. I went to a top 10 soccer school and played for the Olympic development team in non-Olympic years. So that really doesn't count for much. But so in short, I had a pretty linear path to becoming a professional soccer player. There's a bunch of things that I had would have had to do. It wasn't very mature, the professional league in the States at the time. And so it probably would have meant playing in Europe. And
who's your team, by the way? I'm a big football fan. I played soccer, football, baseball. I'm an athlete as well.
Aha.
We're sort of on the same path maybe at first.
Yeah.
What's your team?
Well, my team, this is not a big European club. I'm a huge fan of the Sounders here in Seattle.
Okay.
And that's because I like to celebrate, you know, local, keep it small. But I really appreciate the game. And, you know, I think my parents believed that I was going to pursue that path. And as did all those other sort of the folks in my life at that time, peers that I mentioned, career counselor.
Rabid fans, by the way, in Seattle. No,
I mean, yeah, rabid,
Seattle Seahawks.
Rabid fans.
Yeah. I spent time with Russell Wilson, and
oh, nice.
You know, talked to Russ in depth about Seattle fans and, you know, 12th man, all that stuff.
So passionate, and that's ridiculous. Part of what I love. Yeah, part of what I love about the city for sure is the, you know, there's a people who care deeply about it, people who are from here or live here, and. You know, the 12th man is a sign of that on the football field. And I think the Sounders, you know, the little rabbit hole here, but, you know, when they launched their professional team here for the MLS, the the model that they now use to launch other franchises is basically based on what they did in Seattle. It's very, very successful. They have the largest average home attendance. And I think that's a tribute both to the passion that Seattle has for its sports in general. I mean, we're way up here in the corner, right? All the weirdos just kept going west. And then when there's no more room to go west, they kept going north. And so we're tucked up here in the corner, but there's a lot of passion. If you can think about how, you know, my parents at the time, like, oh, my kid's going to be a professional soccer player. There's a lot of, you know, back padding that goes on. Yeah. And
was Clint Dempsey the franchise player at the time there?
Yeah. This was before, I mean, he was the franchise player when I was, probably at my peak of Sounders fandom, but I'm older, considerably older than Clint. My soccer folks, I went to played college with Marcelo Balboa, Eric Winalda. Those were guys that were on my soccer team, which were some of the top players in the United States soccer history. Kobe Jones, Brad Friedel. Mm-hmm. Those are all guys that I went to college with. So
yeah.
If you just, you know, to get back to your original question, the way that I believe my parents saw, oh, he's going to, you know, be a professional athlete. We're going to get, and this is not malicious by any way, but I think they felt good about that. And at some point, you know, my last year of playing college soccer, I was just burnt and really was not interested in pursuing that. And the, you know, concept in our culture is, wait a minute, like, it's not about being good with pursuing it. If you can do that, you do it, because, you know, how many people have the chance to do that? But I didn't. And, you know, then I said, okay, well, I'll be a doctor, because I had an opportunity to go to medical school. And in short, I bailed on professional soccer, bailed on a career in medical school, and dropped out of a PhD in philosophy in sort of three consecutive years in order to become a photographer. And
how'd that go over with your parents?
Exactly. And my parents are loving and caring people. You know, this is really, I think, an important piece of my story that I'm hoping to, if you walk away with anything from this conversation today and you're listening or watching, it's that you really do have one life. And the people who are around you, this is part of what's confusing, is they love you very much, but the wishes and the plans and the hopes that they have for you, those are theirs. And in order to find your own thing and discover it and then pursue it is incredibly hard. And I want to acknowledge that I am, you know, from so much privilege, white, male, born in the United States, you know, during a time of growth. And the reality is, if I thought that it was so hard to quit the things that everybody else wanted for us, and there are people who come from far less advantage, it's just, I think it's a really hard thing culturally. And that is, I'm trying to encourage, you know, through the books that I've written and, you know, my career, to help people understand that you got one shot. And by pursuing the things that really make your heart sing, and it's hard to describe the amount of energy and connection and just life force it gives you to pursue something that you really love deeply. And that has been my journey. And it's now the journey that I'm on to try and help others discover that same stuff.
Give me some context on that intersection in your life, you know, where you came to the doctor road, or the, you know, where you split off from being an athlete. What year was that?
So I went to college 1989, 1990, 1991, 1992, 1993, 1994. So I was a 5-year college person, in part because of athletics at Division I. They really encourage you to spread that out so you can focus on sports. And so pro soccer would have followed directly from that. As it turns out, medical school would have been the year after. And then the year after that, when I decided not to attend medical school and instead be a ski bum, it was the following year that I then, okay, cool, I'm going to go to graduate school and at least get a PhD in philosophy, because that's something, again, these are all sort of, I'm deferring. Okay, I'm not going to be a pro athlete. Okay, I'll be a doctor. Oh, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'll still be a doctor, but I'll be a PhD in philosophy. And then, you know, I'm just basically like going further and further away from my soul and lower on the cultural totem pole as far as, you know, most folks are concerned. But short story too long, that was probably in the, we'll just call it the late 90s.
Yeah. So and, the reason I want to just earmark it or identify it is because 95, sounds like 95, 96. I mean, this is the beginning of the internet. This is like dial-up internet. AOL is still shipping out CDs. literally, you know, everyone is just starting to plug in online. No one has a website yet, probably.
No.
E-commerce is not a thing. We did not buy things online. I remember a time saying, well, I don't feel safe putting my credit card into this computer. You know, yeah. I think I'm going to get jacked. Right.
Yeah, that's the I remember time buying holiday. Yeah. I remember the first time we bought holiday presents on the internet. It was very controversial.
Yeah.
Like, we're putting our credit card. Into the internet. Mm-hmm. And I think that is actually helpful in framing, you know, temporarily what's going on, because of it's now virtually impossible for us to remember what it was like in a pre-internet world. I mean, I used to get lost. I had a passion for photography, and I spent a lot of my time as a well-respected athlete on the other side of the camera, for football, for soccer, you know, skateboarding, BMX. Those were things that my parents and my grandparents, and I would appear in the local paper. And so I remember starting to have this affinity to photography, not because it was about me, but it was just it was capturing a moment that was never going to happen again. And I sort of became enamored with that. And it was funny to go full circle and to have that sort of seed that was planted when I was a younger person come home to roost, if you will, in my early to mid 20s, when I, you know, decided that I was pursuing all these other things. And what I really wanted to do was to be able to take pictures and travel the world and, you know, help people connect with these, you know, experiences that one could have or see or participate in. And it was a really, it came from a very genuine place. And I remember not knowing enough about photography, so going to the library, and there was this, you know, this is a scenario where I'm looking to sort of, again, plant the seed with anyone who's listening, that I would get lost in research. I was willing to, you know, do anything to chase down a picture. I'm, you know, when you're sitting reading a book in the library and they're like, hey, yo, dude, knock, 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 you got to go, the place is closed. And you're like, oh, when you truly lose track of time and space, because you're so connected or you have genuine knowledge versus the kind of knowledge that you're trying to acquire in high school or college, which is sort of rote and memorization. You know, education and learning took on a whole different angle for me when I tapped into the thing that I was so passionate about. And there was a couple of other things. My grandfather died, then I was given his cameras. That was another big sort of, you know, moment that I look back on. And so I began to walk the earth and went to Europe and lived out of a backpack for 6 months with my then girlfriend, now wife, and taught myself how to take pictures with the goal of pursuing it professionally. And I started making it happen.
So I just want to go back, because I appreciate you sharing that. That's a really great thing. And a couple of things that started ringing my bell a little bit, I just want to underscore for the people who might have missed it because it was subtle. What I picked up on that was really valuable that you just said was about signals. So certainly inheriting cameras from your grandfather is a signal, you know, that lit you up apparently. Spending all that time in the library and someone, you know, basically losing track of time, signals. I think signals are all around us, and sometimes they can be subtle and we miss them or we take them for granted and we don't identify. It's a concept that a lot of other people have talked about a lot, which is self-awareness, which is so logical and important and has been around since the beginning of time, but it's also worth mentioning. And then I want to circle back to these expectations, because I'll share a quick story about my father-in-law, who had the expectation for my wife, my girlfriend at the time, and now my wife. He said to her, this is a real quote, sorry, Dad, but he said, you know, and this was like in high school, I think he was junior year or something. He said, make sure you take a lot of those typing classes, because you're going to need it when you're a secretary. And I was like, how about she's going to need it when she's the boss of her company? Yeah. How about that? So, you know, what you said is true, is we have to really be careful. And not always. Like sometimes the source is spot on, and the people that love us the most know us the most, right? Know us very well. But other times we have to be careful of the context, you know, because that's an era in which he grew up in, that, you know, he wasn't trying to be sexist or or, you know, minimize her potential, but he was just seeing the world as he grew up in it. And,
right. And the reality is all of that's in the past.
Right.
And that's part of why these messages can be confusing, right? Because yeah. A, they're from people that we care about or care about us deeply. Yeah. And B, they're from a different time. And most yeah. of the jobs that you might want, or your girlfriend at the time, or girlfriend at the time, now wife, they probably didn't exist when, you know, her father yeah. was alive to give her a lens through which he wanted her to see the world. And those yeah. two things can be very dangerous and come from a very innocent, sweet, maybe even a caring place.
For sure.
So that's part of what makes them tricky.
Yeah, it is tricky. And I think we have to be careful, because I don't think it's binary. I don't think it's like that's good and that's bad. I think it's like we have to run it through the filter to say, oh, my grandpa grew up in the Great Depression, and no wonder he doesn't want to spend any money or take risks. No wonder he's risk averse. My dad grew up, you know, he's a hippie, and it's the opposite. It's like fun and fancy free. So no wonder he's fun and fancy free. He, you know, his dad grew up in the Depression. He grew up in the 60s, right? So as we run it through these filters, as we understand what's happening, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, I feel like you really can't reconcile your present until you understand your past, right? And so yeah. as you understand sort of your roots, where you came from, the intentions, factoring that all in, it's important when you're making decisions. So thank you for pointing that out, because I think it's
yeah.
invaluable.
It's so true. And it's often overlooked. And I think that's, I have had the good fortune of tapping into the thing that I was put on this planet to do, or something that I have developed and grown that, you know, makes my heart sing. And it's very hard for me to overstate the value that I think that brings to me, yeah. to the people around me, and to the world, when I'm connected to that handful of things. And it is a life force. There's a life force behind that I believe is available to everyone. And you already said it a couple of times, you know, really intelligently, Brian, what this is, just like self-awareness. And I call it, you know, our calling, our intuition, because we know what lights us up and we know what turns us off. And it's just unclear to us that we are actually in the driver's seat, and we can move closer to the things that turn us on and light us up, and move further away from the things that don't, and be true to ourselves, be authentic. That is available to us. And again, being aware of privilege, even just the motion toward that thing creates connections and creates momentum and inertia and energy, which is vital to do anything worth doing.
Let's play the other side of it. Let's assume, sure. And I think this is age agnostic. I think you could be, I mean, let's face it, a lot of bad things are happening right now. And my friends who have jobs, they're all dropping like flies. Even mm-hmm. the most talented, high up, you know, safest, let's say safe with quotes, they are getting furloughed, let go, fired, whatever you want to call it. And they might be in their 40s and 50s and they need to reboot. Scary yeah. stuff. But let's assume, play the other side of it, that we don't know what lights us up. We have an inclination. You know, I like this, I like that. Let's go back to what you started to allude to, what I think Sir Ken Robinson would call your element, you know, bird in the air, fish to the water. It's not always as obvious as we might think. You might have these ideas like, oh, I want to be a doctor because that sounds good. Or maybe the salary is great. Or I want to help people. Mm-hmm. Or I want to be a photographer because I want to capture experiences as they happen. I want to see the world. But like, how do we truly identify? And let's say maybe some of these people have 2, 3, 4, 5 options. How do we pick one? How do we know what our passion is? How do we know what we should go towards? Mm.
Love this question, Brian. And I love it because it's so, it's tactical. Everyone has been there, or if you haven't been there, you're about to be there, or you just came from there, or this is something that so many of us know. And to me, these are the things that we ought to be teaching, you know, our young people, is how, you know, to journey this direction rather than sort of out there. And for me, I like to align around a phrase, and the phrase is action over intellect. because this notion that you put forward there, like, oh, well, we might want to be a doctor, or might want to be, that's all those things are coming to us from the couch, right? We're our asses on the couch and we're thinking about what we might want to be and do. And that's part of the trap.
Yeah.
And the trap is multidimensional. Again, it comes from people that care about us. It comes from culture. It comes from this thing that, you know, this is the brain. This is not our brain. This is a piece of a tissue that we need to get to work for us. Its job is not there to make you happy or fulfilled or connected. Its job is to make you alive. And so by, you know, if you sort of triangulate all those things that I just mentioned, if we are able to take action over intellect, not sure if you want to be a doctor, go volunteer at an emergency room. Yeah. Not sure if you want to be a, you know, fill in the blank, go do that. Get close to these things, because it's in that closeness and in action that we actually come to understand something versus this brain trying to tell us if we're going to like something or not. The research is really clear. It turns out we're really bad at predicting what will make us happy until we do something.
Yeah. I love this idea of trying it on for size. I love it because sometimes it's the only way. It's like process of elimination. You get into it and you're like, this doesn't fit well. I don't love it. I can't do this for the rest of my life. Yeah. That's
or even for a week. Like I volunteered again, part of, you know, your application to medical school is X hundreds of hours of, you know, community service and volunteer work. And I worked in children's hospital around sick kids with the goal of like changing them, because what a, you know, amazing if you could, you know, anytime a child is sick, it's just, ugh, I feel so gutted. And so I wanted to dedicate my, and, but that was all intellectual. That was like from reading books and like, wouldn't it be cool to save kids and, you know, help make, awesome. And then you go work in a hospital and I'm like, oh, this is, I'm not cut out for this. And, you know, this for, you know, for X litany of reasons. So this action over intellect is something that's very, again, I write a lot about that in my book, Creative Calling. And it's something that I've come to know. And, you know, through my podcast and through Creative Live, it just so happens that, you know, hundreds of the world's top performers that are my peers that I've had on my show, or, you know, this is a very consistent theme. There was an aspiration from far away, and then there's an application of effort towards it. And it's the application of effort that really reveals whether or not this is a good fit, whether this is a good fit or not.
Let's qualify that. I know we both have a mutual friend in Seth Godin, and Seth probably gave me one of the, I mean, he's given me some of the best advice ever.
Amazing person.
One thing that sticks out as it relates to this is, he said the person who fails the most wins, because built into that notion is that you get to keep trying until you figure it out. The person who fails is the person who never tries at all. Or we're not just talking about trying stuff on. Now that person fails too far that they can't come back and play another day. It's, you know, think of it like, I'm going to jump out of the airplane, but I forgot my parachute. You got one shot at it. And that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about fail fast, low risk, try it on for size. You know, you can, there's an exit clause.
Get you're not close to the things you're curious about.
You haven't spent your life savings to do it. You know, there's a way out if it doesn't work out. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reality is there are very few doors that once you walk through them, you can't walk back out of them, especially in the arena of professional or career experience. You know, you can try so many of these things on for size. And to further the Seth Godin, you know, moment, he and I were just on the phone together this last week, actually. And he talks about it in terms of unlimited bowling. Look, when you pay $20 to go bowling, you grab your ball and you look up there and you realize you've got 10 frames. You got 10 bowls, 10 shots. Or when you used to put a roll of film in a camera, you're like, I got 36 exposures. And now the world has dramatically shifted. Bowling does not actually define, you know, or this notion of 10 frames in bowling is, it paints a false picture of life, that life is limited and constrained and has all these aspects of, you can say, oh yeah, life is short and blah, blah. I think life is long, trying on things and pursuing them. And what if you had unlimited bowling, wouldn't you throw all kinds of balls and learn to spin it and throw it straight and get strikes and spares? And sure, you'd blow a few things, but this idea that we only get 10 rolls or 36 exposures in a camera, you know, now it, you know, when we take a picture with this thing, I mean, I don't know about you. I got 67,000 pictures on my iPhone. Mm-hmm. That's because it doesn't cost us anything to take another shot or to roll another ball down the lane. And that is a notion that is not, I think, popular, or there's not a lot of awareness around that. And that's part of what, you know, to further your point on Seth, I think that's a really important part of tasting lots of things, of exploring your curiosity.
Yeah. And let me just say, for the people who are more experienced in life, that whether you're 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, I mean, age is not a thing anymore, right? Like, yeah, a lot of the barriers have come down, if not all of the barriers. Maybe the barriers are just right here, but I agree with what you're saying, that we can restart, reboot, you know, Brian 2.0, 3.0. I can find new things. It's, you know, it's limitless. You're right. It's a really good point.
And in fact, I would, this is part of, there's all these ancillary benefits to actually tapping into some of the things, to, you know, the funnel may be large and then you try a lot of things. You find some things that you told yourself a story about that you really loved or that are in your past. You're like, wow, I wonder, I loved comic books as a kid. I wonder if I could, you know, draw a comic or work at a comic book or like, and then you pursue those things. And then if you really are able to tap into that thing, let's just say you find the thing that makes your heart sing and you go deep on that thing and you go deep for a decade, probably what you either achieve or get close to is something that smells like mastery. When you truly are world-class at something, anything, I don't care if it's needlepoint or, you know, writing algorithms for computers or tap dancing, it doesn't matter. But once you have tapped into that thing and felt what mastery feels like, or you got close enough to smell it or taste it, here's the cool thing. Your ability to lift and stamp what it feels like to be good at anything, or to tap into that energy that makes your heart sing, it's more available to you because you can recognize it. This is why I encourage people to go deep on things that they're passionate about, and why if you look at someone like, you know, Sir Richard Branson, or someone who's got 400 companies, or a Tim Ferriss, just because Tim's a friend and, you know, he's world-class at lots of things. He's written so many number one bestsellers, and he's, you know, a salsa dancing champion, you know, just like weird things, because he's found out what it feels like to tap into the thing that you want to do, pursued it, mastered it, and then realized there's so many similar things to mastery and to lifelong learning in general that are applicable for the rest of your very, very long life. That's inspiring to me.
Yeah. I'll add to that by saying the advantage of experience, right? You don't know until you get there. When you're young and inexperienced and you don't have the worldview that you do now after you've lived a little bit, can also be a huge asset that maybe we're undervaluing, underappreciating, underusing. Just saying, you know.
Yeah. I couch most of my stuff, for what it's worth. Again, I mentioned my book, Creative Calling, earlier. Like, I couch most of these things in, you know, we talk about finding our passion, but you don't really do that. Again, if you go back to my earlier phrase, action over intellect, you're like, you're creating your life journey. You're creating your life arc. And so, you know, I believe that in three fundamental things. One, every person is creative. Everyone, limitless possibility.
I believe that too.
We are creative machines. And it's not like some people are creative and other people are not, this thing that we're sold in like fourth grade. Everyone's creative by nature. Like, we're co-creating this conversation right now, Brian. And right now someone is creating the journey home from work as they're listening to this, you know, to us in their ears. Yeah. Or, you know, that's a creative act. And if you believe everyone's creative, and then like anything else, creativity is a habit. The more you do it, the better you get, right? It's not a skill. It is a practice. It is a process. And it's a muscle. Mm-hmm. And if you can believe that, if everyone's creative, and if creativity is a muscle, Maya Angelou said it best, creativity is an infinite resource. The more you have, the more you get. The more you use it, the more you have. Like, I think that is a really interesting process. And then thing three, this lands at, it's literally through creating in small daily ways that we build the muscles that give us the ability to create the living and the life that we want for ourselves. It's the only way. Yeah. I mean, they call us entrepreneurs founders, but I don't know about you. I didn't find anything. I created it. It's not like I was walking through the woods and stubbed my toe on Creative Live or on a best-selling book. I created those things. And it was through this process of learning to trust oneself and believing that we have the tools or we can acquire the tools that will help us on our journey.
I love that. I think we've come back circle, at least in my mind. My mind works in metaphors and analogies. And I was imagining the beautiful game as you were talking. And Isn't it interesting that the word that they use most in the beautiful game of soccer is creativity? Look how creative he is or she is.
With the ball, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And then, off the ball. Sure, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and that creativity allows you to escape the defense or to, let's say, score. You know, that's pretty cool. I like that.
And it's so fundamental. And, you know, that's, my journey when I realized that and built a living and life for myself that I really cared about in the face of so many, you know, people that I loved dearly who were telling me I was off base, and to tap into that and then be able to own it. I want to make sure that people know this is not something like I just beat my chest and round did it. It was confusing and halting. And I was $100,000 in student debt. And, you know, I probably burned a dozen years of my life pursuing the things, you know, I got 10 years, 12 years off course. And so it's never too late. And that's I think a really important takeaway is you might be 10,000 hours away from the thing that you were put on this planet to do, for the big dream that you have that you've been postponing because all of the list of things, the mortgage, the partner, the business, all of those things, you might be 10,000 hours away. And sometimes that can be frustrating or scary or make you not want to even try. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. You might be 10,000 hours away, but you're one decision. And all that decision is a decision to try, to take action toward that thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm banking that once you taste that thing and try that thing or try a few things and land on the thing that you know is true for you, that your life has changed. And that to me is exciting, and it's available to everybody right now. As you said earlier, doesn't matter if you're 20 or 80.
Yeah. What's something that you believed like 5 years ago pretty firmly? It could be something in business, or it could be even be, you know, something not business related that you no longer believe is true. Something you really held fast to, it was your thing 5 years ago, believed it was true, and then now that's out the window.
Depending on when you're listening or watching this particular conversation with, you know, between Brian and myself here, we are in the middle of a pandemic, and I would say that my belief that culture at that scale was more like the Titanic than something that was capable of turning or changing on a dime. And the thing that I believed 5 years ago was that most of these things were true. And by true, I mean that the economy couldn't possibly change that fast, that there wasn't a world where we were one day going to be sitting with our friends in a restaurant and the next day not. And what I have learned, what I know is true now, or what I believe to be true that I didn't hold 5 years ago, a belief was that it can all change in a moment. And maybe that moment is, you know, was that, you know, when the first cases were diagnosed or when they hit the shores of the US or what, like maybe even the moment is a couple of months, but it can change so much faster. And something on that scale changing that fast was something I did not think that was possible. And yet here we are. So, you know, by logical extension, now you say, what can you do with that? To me, if that doesn't motivate the action that you want to pursue, the thing that you're postponing for a reason that isn't really clear, or that is a story that we've told ourselves at best, then, you know, what are you doing with this one precious life? And, you know, it's my hope that, that we can use this time to reorganize some priorities. And look, I want to be very crystal clear that there are frontline workers, there are people who are in harm's way or have lost loved ones and for whom this is not that period. So I do not want to be sort of like painting with a brush that's so broad.
Yeah.
But if you're able to be listening and watching this, and you know, that already qualifies you to be sort of maybe in the West or maybe of a certain socioeconomic status where you have a something you can put in your ears or you can, you know, log into a computer, then I believe that, you know, this is a cue for us. And that's the thing. I 5 years ago, I always believed that we wanted to find these things, but that culture could shift so fast and point right to the source. Like, yo, you gotta do you, mm-hmm. because here we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very disturbing and empowering at the same time. And fortunately, we have the ability as humans to manage both those things. We can be horrified that racial injustice has lasted so long. We can be mortified that there's a pandemic where millions of people are dying. And we can also hold that and use it as fuel, as motivation, as connection. And, you know, we're complex and we should be, it's okay if you're struggling to manage those two things. And the reality is that those things can coexist. And my hope is that we can all, you know, take notice of the things that are the messages that are coming at us and make use of them in a way that's positive and constructive.
Yeah, I like that advice and those thoughts. I think a couple things came to mind while you were thinking about it, sparked another idea. Is this, I think we have to be careful of the false dichotomy, you know, and I probably still don't really understand false dichotomies, but it's this idea, kind of what you're talking about, where we can be very concerned. We can be highly sensitive and empathetic and do everything that we can regarding what's happening with the world coming unhinged. And we can also look for opportunities, especially if we feel like our lives or career is in the ashes right now. There's, you know, yeah, that Phoenix rising thing is a thing because it is a thing. So we can actually do both, right? It doesn't have to be all, you know, I'm dead, woe is me, and there's a mourning period. We can actually have simultaneous emotions of feeling down and feeling like everything is really bad right now, but also like, now what am I going to do about it? And look for opportunities. And, you know,
and that's another thing. We're probably not taught that. That's, you know, I keep going back to, what are the things that I wish we were better at, and how can I have an impact to change those? That's one of the reasons Creative Live exists. That's why I write books, because I believe that that is not a thing that we're taught. We're taught things are good or bad.
Yeah.
And then you move on and you observe the thing, and then you take that thing and you do something with it, versus, you know, it's okay to have conflicting feelings and to be confused or to be stuck. Like, let's face it, so much of what I'm talking about is sort of paralysis, whether it's through, you know, cultural pressure or, you know, family connections or what the world thinks of us. Let's be real. We're social animals.
Yeah.
We want to fit in. That's part of, like, that's literally, if a human baby is not held, that human baby dies. You know, we are social animals. And so the desire to fit in and connect, and it's real.
Yeah.
This is not about being an introvert or an extrovert. This is about a very deep wiring, a biological wiring. So
yeah,
these, you know, frustrations and stop and go that you felt as a young person, or you're feeling now trying to get into a second career, be kind to yourself, be gentle. You're working against your biology, and it's because the times and culture is shifting a lot faster than our biology was intended for it to shift.
Yeah.
So there's no saber-toothed tigers on the horizon by and large, right? And yet we connect the number of likes we get on our most recent Instagram post with real actual fear, that, you know, life or death fear. And the reality is that's just the closest approximation. And that's why I go back to mindset. We need to learn to control this multi-million-year-old organ that's between our ears. you know, you are not your thoughts. That's why meditation is so effective. You can watch your thoughts. Your thoughts are not you. If you can start to tap into this, you know, I keep going back to the great word that you use, Brian, which is, you know, awareness. You can have the awareness to listen to what is in your heart, to take action towards those things, to learn through mistakes and be able to feel both energized and anxious, you know, because anxious it feels a lot like excitement if you had a different headspace. The feelings in the body are similar. And so, you know, this is part of what I'm trying to put out there in the lexicon of, you know, what it means to be a person in 2020.
Yeah.
And it's okay. And more so if like we get used to it and comfortable with it and use the word failure, lightweight failures over time, that's, you know, is another way of describing progress.
Yeah.
So
agreed.
You know, and I'm soapboxy there. Sorry.
No, I preach because I think you and I take it for granted because we've been on this side of it. I mean, we were talking a little bit off camera that I worked for someone else. I had a big job at a big Hollywood studio. I was walking the red carpet with movie stars. I had a $40 million P&L, and I did everything you could do in brand marketing and strategy that one could do. I mean, name it, TV. You know, we were buying upfront media on Survivor season one and billboards, radio, you know, internet, it all. And I had a blast. I learned a ton about branding, marketing, advertising. But there was a point where as an industry, we needed to reinvent ourselves because we could no longer, or we could see a day where we could no longer justify selling these movies on DVD for $25. And so we came up with this thing called added value. And as an industry, we thought of stuff like alternative endings or bloopers or director's commentary. And I found myself standing next to a camera and talent was being interviewed. And I thought, I'm sort of directing here. I'm producing, directing. This is kind of fun. And so I started quietly observing and asking questions like, oh, what kind of camera are you using? What are those microphones? What is aperture? What is ISO? You know, what do you use to edit? Framing, all these different things. And so I secretly plotted my escape with the plan to start this production company, which I did in 2007, fourth quarter. And
nice timing.
Perfect timing, right? Like, yep. Had all these great plans, had all these kind of client projects lined up. People are excited that I was, you know, free and available to do work for them. And then 2008 hit and it was all gone. And that's why this show came about, because I literally needed to find the solution to my problem because I was bleeding out. And if I could offer anything about what's changed for me, it really was an eye opener. And I have to give credit back to Seth again for pointing this out. Like in 2008, 2009, when we started really becoming better friends, he said, Brian, you're waiting to get picked. There's no Prince Charming in this story. I'm sorry. No one's coming. There are no rescue boats. So now what? And so this time around, you know, a decade plus 2 years later, it feels very familiar. You know, fortunately, I am in charge of my destiny. You know, I get to control whether I'm the hero or not. I wasn't in as much control back then. But the thing that's different this time that I don't believe anymore is that I don't believe anyone's coming. And I need to save myself. No one that I know of is thinking about me and how to advance my career right now, how to put more money in my bank account so I can pay my mortgage and get my kids to new shoes for school, and no one's thinking about me. I guarantee it. And so that's what's really different, is I'm not holding my breath anymore. And that was actually hard for me based on my upbringing, my life path. I was playing the victim, I think, for a lot of understandable reasons, but I try not to slip back into that. Sometimes I do catch myself playing the victim. And I think, no one cares.
This is literally the part of me that's not serving me.
Just nobody cares. They really don't. Yeah. It's harsh. It's sad, but true. And it's a little poem I've made for myself, you know, sad, but true. No one cares as much as you. And that's just the way it is. So it's not that I don't care about other people, but I do have to make sure that I'm taking care of business and not just sort of waiting for it to fall, the manna from heaven, whatever you want to call it, you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's a real way of thinking about it. You know, my lens is super similar. I frame it in a way of like possibility, and I think there's a creative process, you know, having been a professional creator, shooting ad campaigns for Nike and Apple and so many of the world's top 100 brands for a decade, and directing television commercials. You mentioned the LA Hollywood thing, doing all that stuff. And starting, you know, multiple companies, some company like Creative Live that has, you know, tens of millions of students. It's an online learning platform. When I think about whether I'm solving a problem today, a creative problem, whether I'm trying to build a business or I'm, you know, again, this goes back to this, like it's small muscles over time that create this, or whether I'm trying to like create my life, I've developed this idea that a creative process it's just four steps: imagining what's possible, right? Because we're really not taught to imagine. You're taught to imagine these 18 narrow options. You want to be this or this or this or this when you grow up, versus like what is possible for this one precious life. So
yeah. And I'll just chime in that, you know, the hindsight of experience now, which is another way of saying age, all that imagining, it changes. Like what I wanted or imagined in my 20s changed a decade later in my 30s, you know? And so carry on, please.
No. This idea of a creative process, whether I'm, you know, trying to create a presentation for work, trying to make a new app, trying to create a photograph or create my life. Imagine it's the acronym is IDEA, IDEA. These are the four parts of my book. Imagine what's possible. Design a plan to get you there. Execute that plan and amplify all of the results you get along the way. And the amplify part, it's basically another word for community. None of these things, while no one cares about you, if you bring them along on the journey, that's the closest that they can get to caring. You know, building community is the secret to the success that most people seek. And by being able to then, you know, reduce a very complex thing like life or like any project when it's overwhelmed, like, look at, I want to just these four steps. And if you do these four steps, and you know, I've deconstructed the successes and failures that I've had in my life. And comparatively, I've done the same with, you know, many of the top creators and entrepreneurs in so many different walks of life. And when things work, you have all four of these things present. And when things don't, or when you only get halfway to your dream, or when you're living somebody else's dream, arguably worse, you're not really doing this whole process. And so, you know, this is something that, you know, it's taken me 30 years to figure this out, but I would encourage people at home, like, oh, you know, got a problem, you know, just throw this simple acronym at it. Like, what, imagine the solution, design a series of steps that could get you there, even if it's, you know, 10 years or 10,000 hours or 10 steps, I don't care. Execute the plan and then bring others along. Tell them about your journey. Help, you know, connect with them so they can help you. It's a pretty simple, you know, scarily simple. But again, it's a process that when I've deconstructed, you know, so many different projects from so many different walks of life and so many different backgrounds and people, all these things are present.
I'm curious about what sticks in your mind as a failure? Because you said, you know, failures. Mm. And, you know, I ask it from the point of view of what did you learn from it? You know, like.
Sure. I feel like so much of, I like to use failure in the small f, I believe that small F failures are stepping stones to success. I think that's just another way of talking about learning, and it's hard to beat somebody who never quits. So if you think about failures as lowercase Fs, I think that helps you avoid failures with a capital F. Mm-hmm. You know,
still painful, though.
Still very painful, still very emotional. All of those things can, again, we're complex people, so all those things can be true, and you can learn incredibly valuable lessons and apply those things. And in fact, anyone who accomplishes anything has done that. That is the process by which, you know, for an able-bodied child, it is virtually unthinkable to say, you know what, my kid just fell down for the 19th time. Mm-hmm. Guess she's not a walker.
Yeah. I mean, you can win the lottery and you can catch the Hail Mary pass, but it's
for sure.
It's an anomaly.
But by and large, it's you stumbled, you need to get back up.
Yeah.
And we can have that attitude towards something like walking, but culturally it's very taboo to have that around entrepreneurship or pursuing your dream or, you know, all these things that are so easily cast aside. And
right. And
so go ahead.
And I was just going to say, maybe it's obvious, but one of the most challenging things for me was the fact that I brought my family on this roller coaster ride. And so I think that's where some of the difficulty comes back. Cause if it was just up to me, I mean, I could eat like crackers, live in a cardboard box, man, I can hunker down, dude, like with the best of them. And I can live off of nothing because I have. The painful, difficult part was my family saying, how much longer are we going to give this? Because it's not working. It doesn't seem like it's working. And me having to say, I have a plan. Let's stay the course. I have these little signals. I believe that it's going to work. I don't have a guarantee. That's the hard part, isn't it?
Yeah. But that's the amplify part, the community part of this four-part system that I have is – if you did not tell them what your dream was, and if you were just dragging them along with you through the mud and the hard stuff, and they didn't believe in you because they didn't know what you were up to, you know, they would be a lot less likely to go on the ride with you.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
But part of building community, this is why telling people your secrets and putting it out there into the universe and, you know, doing everything you can to bring others and to connect. Again, go back to the fact that we're social animals. If you socialize this with your family, they are much more likely to go on the journey. And this, you know, go back to my particular story. I had not socialized the idea with my friends and peers when I bailed on professional soccer, dropped out of medical school and quit a PhD in 3 consecutive years to become a photographer. People thought I was nuts.
Yeah.
And that was really one of my earliest lessons. Like, wait a minute. What if I had just done a much better job of connecting and sharing what was truly in here, this and being aware of it, go back to your word, and then sharing that, like that is such a powerful vehicle because you cannot deny the energy behind the passion, the connection, the cultivation of the energy required to do important, hard, meaningful things that you care deeply about.
Yeah.
If you're connecting with your family sees you doing this work. It helps so much. And this is why so many people right now, I hope you're realizing like, gosh, I really haven't brought other people along on my big dream. I'm embarrassed to say what it is. I'm not sure what it is. I've, you know, been told that it's crazy. And, you know, if we can affect with this conversation, just one person who decides to give it a go. And to be clear, what you've thought of as entrepreneurship or taking a chance and like, second mortgage, going all in, that's actually not the way that it works either. If you look at the world's top entrepreneurs, they're always managing the downside, and it's small, imperfect actions towards that calling on our path. Your path can change, but it's this pursuit and this connection that you have with the thing and then bringing other people along on that journey with you that's where so much of the richness of life exists.
I completely agree. It's really easy. Easier said than done. The hard part.
Oh, yeah.
The hard part is getting enrollment. Sure. You know, you have to persuade the people that are sitting in the passenger seat and in the back seats buckled in for dear life. And I think the challenge is just like you said, I had this conversation with my daughter who said, Dad, you love risk, don't you? And I was like, actually, no, I don't. I like to mitigate risk. And I would, I'm happy to speak for most people in my shoes that are doing entrepreneurial things is we're very strategic about our decisions most of the time, aren't we? Like,
yeah,
we think it through, we plan, you know, we make plans, and plans can change and things don't always work out, but we're trying our best. Instead of taking that giant leap of faith, we want to take more of a hop step, and we're trying to mitigate and close that gap as much as possible, and then take our little hop, not leap to our death. That's not the intention.
Yeah, yeah. And we've glamorized that and glorified it. And the reality is, if you there's always the exceptions, but by and large, the metaphor that stands the test of time is small, imperfect actions in the direction of the thing that you want.
Yeah, it's wise advice. It's timeless. That always works. I feel safe to say that never fails. That's,
you know. Yeah, you can't beat someone who doesn't quit, right? It's like, that's part of the, you know, and I gotta qualify that, because quitting, you know, the flip side of that same coin has been, you know, demonized in our culture, and all the smartest, most talented, hardworking, best people that I know, people that I love and adore, they're actually really good at quitting the things that don't serve them or their vision or mission for their one precious life. And so,
yeah. Well, let's talk about that.
I'm talking about not quitting the things that you care deeply about.
What are the signals? Like, how long do we give this quote great idea until we cut bait? What are the signals? Mm. How should we be measuring success?
I think my friend Chris Guillebeau captured this as eloquently as I've ever heard it. And that is, you know, how to decide when to keep going is, do I love it? It's just a simple it's a little 2x2 matrix. Do I love it? Is it working? And if you love it and it's working, duh. If you don't love it and it's working,
right?
I don't love this.
Yeah.
Doing something you don't love that's working is like, meh. Now, what are the other two? I don't love it and it's not working. Duh.
No brainer. Yeah.
Right. So if it's not working, but you love it, that's when you have to go inside. Do I love it enough? And if you're truly doing the thing that you love, not that someone else prescribed or not that you saw on TV or not you decided for yourself from the couch, like, that is part of the juice that I'm talking about, that I want to get you who's listening or watching right now to be straight with yourself. And that is part of how I became one of the top commercial photographers in the world, is part of how I, you know, truly, through a really imperfect, ugly process, landed myself at a place where I became enough, not nailed it, but just enough where the motivation to do that thing was just one click more than the shame or the guilt of not doing it.
Yeah.
Just one click more. And that's where I was able to find the thread that I was able to pull on and realize that, oh my God, this is one of the most important things that we can discover about ourselves and about the world, yeah, is that everything around us was created. Everything. This microphone, the camera, the internet, my can, the table, it was all created, and it was probably created by someone less dynamic, less creative, less attuned to what they want in the world than you are. Mm-hmm. So if not you, who? And if not now, when?
Yeah. You're a quote guy just like me. I love all those quotes. That's a Steve Jobs quote. You quoted Babe Ruth before. Can't be someone who never quits. I love that. I have an ROJ acronym, which is the return on joy equation for me. Because I think you really need to going back to knowing thyself. I mean, you can be this attorney, and maybe you value stability over being truly fulfilled. And you need to really reconcile that, because what is at the top of that hierarchy of needs? For me, it was joy. I valued joy and fulfillment over stability. That's the reality. And that's why I decided to leave, because I'm okay with being uncomfortable. I'm okay with uncertainty, turns out. It wasn't always. You know, it was a muscle I had to develop. But I became aware that that's where my value is, and really, truly being happy in what I do. And that's why I was okay stepping away from the safe zone. and trying to go for it. Now, I can't say the same for my wife, who is a realist, and that's okay. She's also an artist, but she does not like uncertainty and does not like surprises. And that's okay too. Like, we're just, you know, hardwired different ways. And so she's a lot more careful, methodical, meticulous before she makes that, pulls that trigger. And that's okay too.
That's probably why you guys are a great fit. There's a combination of those two things that we, like, all the best stuff in life is on the other side of the fear. But if you just jumped before you read the instructions off it with your parachute, you might be in trouble. So,
yeah. Well, this has been an excellent conversation, wide ranging. I've enjoyed it. Any final thoughts as we put a cap on this one?
I was going to, you know, maybe leave with another quote, but you already nailed that, the Socrates quote, know thyself. Let's see. Maybe I'll go back to something I said, opening, which is everyone is creative and your creativity is the thing. And again, creativity by it, I don't mean just art. Art is just a teeny subset of creativity. Creativity is the ability to solve problems, to move through the world, to be able to create any outcome that you want to create. And if you can believe that you're creative and you can understand that creativity is a muscle and the more you use it, the more you have, then it only stands to reason that it's through creating in small, regular ways. What are you doing to develop a habit of creativity, a way of looking at the world such that you can create not just things and, you know, outcomes on a small daily basis, but these are the tools that we need to, you know, to imagine, to design, to execute and amplify the life that we have, the one precious life that we're given. And to me, if you can even just get going towards that, there is a whole other world waiting for you.
I love it. That's probably a great place to cut. I'll leave you with one of my favorite quotes, which is,
please do. Please. I love, we're quote swapping here.
From another famous Eliot, T.S. Eliot, who said, "We must not cease from exploration. And the end of all of our exploring will be to end where we first began and to know the place for the very first time."
I don't know, Brian Elliott sound a lot like T.S. Eliot there. I'm sure you got a little bit of that somewhere, maybe in your DNA. Yeah, thank you so much for the conversation, Brian. Love your show. Want to recognize you and give you a shout out for all the work you put in for, as you said, a decade plus 2 years, and it doesn't go unnoticed. And I want to say congratulations. You're really having a positive impact on the world. And I'm happy for you and the show, and just hats off, man.
I mean, we were just sitting back, you know, chopping it up, reminiscing about the good old days and all that, you know, tracking my roots, where I came from and where I'm going. But like I say, man, always said it, it's not about the destination, it's all about the journey.